Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. Tonight we bring you My Old Man by Ernest Hemingway. Ernest Hemingway was an iconic American journalist and author, known for his brief and straightforward style of writing and for the gusto with which he lived his life. He survived car accidents and plane crashes, as well as mishaps on hunting and fishing expeditions. And if that wasn't enough danger for one man, he crowned it with an exclamation point by marrying 4 times. His experiences during the war led him to abandon abstract languages empty in favor of his hallmark writing style, in which he savored simplified and concrete actions. As if it were so easy. Quote, "There is nothing to writing. All you do is sit down at a typewriter and bleed." And now, My Old Man by Ernest Hemingway. I guess, looking at it now, my old man was cut out for a fat guy. One of those regular little roly fat guys you see around. But he sure never got that way, except a little towards the last. And then it wasn't his fault. He was riding over the jumps only, and he could afford to carry plenty of that weight then. I remember the way he pulled on a rubber shirt over a couple of jerseys and a big sweater shirt over that, and get me to run with him in the forenoon in a hot sun. He'd have maybe taken a trial trip with one of Razzo's skins early in the morning after just getting in from Torino at 4 o'clock in the morning and beaten it to the stables in a cab. And then with the dew all over everything and the sun just starting to get going, I'd help him pull off his boots and he'd get into a pair of sneakers and all these sweaters and we'd start out. "Come on, kid," he'd say, stepping up and down on his toes in front of the jock's dressing room. "Let's get moving." Then we'd start off jogging, around the infield once maybe, with him ahead running nice, and then turn out the gate and along one of those roads with all the trees along both sides of them that run out from San Siro. I'd go ahead of him when he hit the road, and I could run pretty stout, and I'd look around and he'd be jogging easy, just behind me, and after a little while I'd look around again and he'd begun to sweating heavy, and he'd just be clogging it along with his eyes on my back, and when he'd catch me, looking at me, he'd grin and say, "Sweating plenty?" When my old man grinned, nobody could help but grin too. And we'd keep right on running out toward the mountains, and then my old man would yell, "Hey, Joe!" And I'd look back, and he'd be sitting under a tree with a towel he'd had around his waist wrapped around his neck. I'd come back and sit down beside him, and he'd pull a rope out of his pocket and start skipping rope out in the sun with the sweat pouring off his face and him skipping rope out in the white dust with the rope going cloppity-cloppity, clop-clop-clop, and the sun hotter, and him working harder up and down a patch of road. Say, it was a treat to see my old man skip rope, too. He could whir it fast or lop it slow and fancy. Say, you ought to have seen Wops look at us sometimes when they'd come by, going into town, walking along with big white steers hauling the cart. They sure looked as though they thought the old man was nuts. He'd start the rope whirring till they'd stop dead still and watch him, then give the steers a cluck and a poke with the goad and get going again. When I'd sit watching him work out in the sun, I sure felt fond of him. He was sure fun, and he'd done his work so hard, and he'd finish up with a regular whirring that drive the sweat out on his face like water, and then sling the rope at the tree and come over and sit down with me and lean back against the tree with a towel and a sweater wrapped around his neck. "Sure as hell keeping it down, Joe," he'd say, and lean back and shut his eyes and breathe long and deep. "It ain't like when you're a kid." Then he'd get up before he started to cool, and we'd jog along back to the stables. That's the way it was, keeping down the weight, He was worried all the time. Most jocks can just ride off all they want to. A jock loses about a kilo every time he rides. But my old man was sort of dried out, and he couldn't keep down his kilos without all that running. I remember once at San Siro, Regalo, a little wop that was riding for Bozzoni, came out across the paddock, going to the bar for something cool, and flicking his bouts with his whip after he'd just weighed in, and my old man had just weighed in too, and came out with the saddle under his arm, looking red-faced and tired and too big for his silks. And he stood there looking at young Regalo, standing up to the outdoors bar, cool and kid-looking. And I said, "What's the matter, Dad?" 'Cause I thought maybe Regalo had bumped him or something. And he just looked at Regalo and said, "Oh, to hell with it," and went on into the dressing room. Well, it would have been all right, maybe, if we'd stayed in Milan and ridden at Milan and Torino, because if there were any easy courses, it's those two. "Pianola, Joe," my old man said when he dismounted in the winning stall after what the wops thought was a hell of a steeplechase. I asked him once, "This course rides itself. It's the pace you're going at that makes riding the jumps dangerous, Joe. We ain't going any pace here, and they ain't any really bad jumps either. But it's the pace, always, not the jumps, that makes the trouble. San Siro was the swellest course I'd ever seen, but the old man said it was a dog's life, going back and forth between Mirafiori and San Siro and riding just about every day in the week with a train ride every other night. I was nuts about the horses, too. There's just something about it when they come out and go up the track to the post, sort of dancy and tight-looking, with the jock keeping a tight hold on them and maybe easing off a little and letting them run a little going up. Then, once they were in the barrier, it got me worse than anything, especially at San Siro, with that big green infield and the mountains way off, and the fat wop starter and his big whip and the jocks finding them around, and then the barrier snapping up and the bell going off and them getting off in a bunch and then commencing to string out. You know the way a bunch of skins gets off. If you're up in the stands with a pair of glasses, all you see is them plunging off. And then that bell goes off and it seems like it rings for 1,000 years. And then they come sweeping round the turn. There wasn't ever anything like it for me. But my old man said one day in the dressing room when he was getting into his street clothes, "None of these things are horses, Joe. They'd kill that bunch of skates for their hides and hoofs up at Paris." That was the day he won the Premio Commercio with Lantorna, shooting her out of the field the last 100 meters like pulling a cork out of a bottle. It was right after the Premio Commercio that we pulled out and left Italy. My old man in Holbrook and a fat wop in a straw hat that kept wiping his face with a handkerchief were having an argument at a table in the Galleria. They were talking French, and the two of them were after my old man about something. Finally, he didn't say anything anymore, but just sat there and looked at Holbrook, and the two of them kept after him. First one talking and then the other, and the fat wop always butting in on Holbrook. "You go out and buy me a sportsman, will you, Joe?" my old man said and handed me a couple of soldi without looking away from Holbrook. So I went out of the Galleria and walked over in front of the Scalia and bought a paper and came back and stood a little away because I didn't want to butt in, and my old man was sitting back in his chair looking down at his coffee and fooling with a spoon. And Holbrook and the big wop were standing, and the big wop was wiping his face and shaking his head. And I came up, and my old man acted just as though the two of them weren't standing there, and said, "Want an ice, Joe?" Holbrook looked down at my old man and said, slow and careful, "You son of a bitch." And he and the fat wop went out through the tables. My old man sat there and sort of smiled at me, but his face was white, and he looked sick as hell, and I was scared. And I felt sick inside because I knew something had happened, and I didn't see how anybody could call my old man a son of a bitch and get away with it. My old man opened up the Sportsman and studied the handicaps for a while, and then he said, "You gotta take a lot of things in this world, Joe." And 3 days later, we left Milan for good, on the Turin train for Paris, after an auction sale out in front of Turner's stables of everything we couldn't get into a trunk and a suitcase. We got to Paris early in the morning, in a long, dirty station the old man told me was the Gare de Lyon. Paris was an awful big town, after Milan. Seems like in Milan everybody's going somewhere, and all the trams run somewhere, and there ain't any sort of mix-up. But Paris is all balled up, and they never do straighten it out. I got to like it, though, part of it anyway, and say, it's got the best race courses in the world. Seems as though that were the thing that keeps it all going. And about the only thing you can figure on is that every day the buses will be going out to whatever track they're running at, going right out through everything to the track. I never really got to know Paris well, because I just came in about once a week or twice a week with the old man from Mason's, and he always sat at the Café de la Pax on the opera side with the rest of the gang from Mason's, and I guess that's one of the busiest parts of town. But say, it is funny that a big town like Paris wouldn't have a Galleria, isn't it? Well, we went out to live at Mason's Lafitte, where just about everybody lives, except the gang at Chantilly, with Mrs. Myers that runs a boarding house. Mason's is about the swellest place to live I've ever seen in my life. The town ain't so much, but there's a lake and a swell forest that we used to go off humming in all day, couple of us kids. And my old man made me a slingshot, and we got a lot of things with it. But the best one was a magpie. Young Dick Atkinson shot a rabbit with it one day, and we put it under a tree, and we're all sitting around, and Dick had some cigarettes, and all of a sudden the rabbit jumped up and beat it to the bushes. And we chased it, but we couldn't find it. Gee, we had fun at Mason's. Mrs. Myers used to give me a lunch in the morning, and I'd be gone all day. I learned to talk French quick. It's an easy language. As soon as we got to Mason's, my old man wrote to Milan for his license, and he was pretty worried till it came. He used to sit around the Café de Paris in Mason's with the gang there. There were lots of guys he'd known when he'd rode up at Paris, before the war lived at Mason, and there's a lot of time to sit around, because the work round a race stable, for the jocks that is all cleaned up by 9 o'clock in the morning. They take the first batch of skins out to gallop them at 5:30 in the morning, and they work the second lot at 8 o'clock. That means getting up early, all right, and going to bed early, too. If a jock's riding for somebody, too, he can't go boozing around, because the trainer always has an eye on him. If he's a kid, and if he ain't a kid, he's always got an eye on himself. So mostly, if a jock ain't working, he sits around the Café de Paris with the gang, and they can all sit around about 2 or 3 hours in front of some drink, like a vermouth and seltz, and they talk and tell stories and shoot pool, and it's sort of like a club or the Galleria in Milan. Only it ain't really like a Galleria, because there, everybody's going by all the time, and there's everybody around the tables. Well, my old man got his license all right. They sent it through to him without a word, and he rode a couple of times. Amiens, up country, and that sort of thing. But he didn't seem to get any engagements. Everybody liked him, and whenever I'd come into the Café in the forenoon, I'd find somebody drinking with him, because my old man wasn't tight like most of these jockeys that have got their first dollar they made riding at the World's Fair in St. Louis in 1904. That's what my old man used to say when he'd kid George Burns. But it seemed like everybody steered clear of giving my old man any mounts. We went out to wherever they were running every day with the car from Mason's, and that was the most fun of all. I was glad when the horses came back from Deauville and the summer, even though it meant no more humming in the woods, because then we'd ride to Anghein or Tremblay or St. Cloud and watch them from the trainers and jockeys' stand. I sure learned about racing from going out with that gang, and the fun of it was going every day. I remember once out at St. Cloud, it was a big 200,000-franc race with 7 entries and Czar a big favorite. I went around to the paddock to see the horses with my old man, and you never saw such horses. This Czar is a big yellow horse that looks like nothing but run. I never saw such a horse. He was being led around the paddock with his head down, and when he went by me, I felt all hollow inside. He was so beautiful. There never was such a wonderful, lean, running-built horse. And he went around the paddock, putting his feet just so, and quiet and careful, and moving easy, like he knew just what he had to do, and not jerking and standing up on his legs and getting wild-eyed, like you see these selling platters with a shot of dope in them. The crowd was so thick, I couldn't see him again except just his legs going by, and some yellow. And my old man started out through the crowd, and I followed him over to the jock's dressing room hack in the trees, and there was a big crowd around there, too. But the man at the door in a derby nodded to my old man, and we got in. And everybody was sitting around and getting dressed and pulling shirts over their head and pulling boots on, and it all smelled hot and sweaty and linimenty, and outside was the crowd looking in. The old man went over and sat down by George Gardner, that was getting into his pants, and said, "What's the dope, George?" in just an ordinary tone of voice, because there ain't any use him feeling around, because George either can tell him or he can't. "He won't win," George says, very low, leaning over and buttoning the bottoms of his pants. "Who will?" my old man says, leaning over close so nobody can hear. "Kirkabin," says George. "And if he does, save me a couple tickets." My old man says something in a regular voice to George, and George says, "Don't ever bet on anything I tell you," kidding-like, and we beat it out and through all the crowd that was looking in over to the 100-franc mutual machine. But I knew something was up, because George is Czar's jockey. On the way, he gets one of them yellow odds sheets with the starting prices on, and the Czar is paying only 5 for 10. Sophisodote is next at 3 to 1, and fifth down the list is Kirkabin at 8 to 1. My old man bets 5,000 on Kirkabin to win and puts 1,000 to place, and we went around back of the grandstand to go up to the stairs and get a place to watch the race. We were jammed in tight, and first a man in a long coat with a gray tall hat and a whip folded up in his hand came out, and then one after the other the horses, with the jocks up and a stable boy holding the bridle on each side, and walking along followed the old guy. That big yellow horse Czar came first. He didn't look so big when you first looked at him until you saw the length of his legs and the whole way he's built and the way he moves. Gosh, I never saw such a horse. George Gardner was riding him, and they moved along slow back of the old guy in the gray tall hat that walked along like he was the ringmaster in a circus. Back of Czar, moving along smooth and yellow in the sun, was a good-looking black with a nice head, with Tommy Archibald riding him, and after the black was a string of 5 more horses, all moving along slow, in a procession past the grandstand and the passage. My old man said the black was Kirkabin, and I took a look at him. And he was a nice-looking horse, all right, but nothing like Czar. Everybody cheered when Czar went by, and he sure was one swell-looking horse. The procession of them went around on the other side, past the palace, and then back up to the near end of the course, and the circus master had the stable boys turn them loose, one after another, so they could gallop by the stands on the way up to the post and let everybody have a good look at them. They weren't at the post hardly any time at all when the gong started, and you could see them way off across the field, all in a bunch starting on the first swing, like a lot of little toy horses. I was watching them through the glasses, and Czar was running well back, with one of the bays making the pace. They swept down and around and came pounding past, and Czar was way back when they passed us. And this Kirkabin horse in front and going smooth. Gee, it's awful when they go by you, and then you have to watch them go further away and get smaller and smaller, and then all bunched up on the turns, and then come around towards into the stretch, and you feel like swearing and damning worse and worse. Finally, They made the last turn and came into the straightaway with this Kirkabin horse way out in front. Everybody was looking funny, saying czar in a sort of sick way, and then pounding nearer the stretch, and then something came out of the pack right into my glasses, like a horse-headed yellow streak, and everybody began to yell czar as though they were crazy. Czar came on faster than I'd ever seen anything in my life, and pulled up on Kirkabin that was going fast as any black horse could go, with the jock flogging hell out of him with a gad, and they were right dead neck and neck for a second. But Czar seemed going about twice as fast as those great jumps and that head out. But it was while they were neck and neck that they passed the winning post. And when the numbers went up in the slots, the first one was 2, and that meant Kirkabin had won. I felt all trembly and funny inside. And then we were all jammed in with the people going downstairs to the stand in front of the board where they'd post what Kirkabin paid. Honest, watching the race, I'd forgot how much my old man had bet on Kirkabin. I wanted Czar to win so damn bad. But now it was all over, and it was swell to know we had the winner. "Wasn't it a swell race, Dad?" I said to him. He looked at me sort of funny, with the derby on the back of his head. "George Gardner's a swell jockey, all right," he said. "It sure took a great jock to keep that czar horse from winning." Of course, I knew it was funny all the time, but my old man saying that, right out like that, sure took the kick all out of it for me, and I didn't get the real kick back again ever, even when they posted the numbers up on the board and the bell rang to pay off and we saw that Kirkabin paid $67.50 for 10. All around, people were saying, "Poor czar, poor czar." And I thought, I wish I were a jockey, and I could have rode him instead of that son of a bitch. And that was funny, thinking of George Gardner as a son of a bitch, because I'd always liked him. Besides, he'd given us the winner. But I guess that's what he is, all right. My old man had a big lot of money after that race, and he took to coming into Paris oftener. If they raced at Tremblay, he'd have them drop him in town on their way back to Mason's, and he and I'd sit out in front of the Café de la Pax and watch the people go by. It's funny sitting there. There's streams of people going by, and all sorts of guys come up, and they want to sell you things. And I love to sit there with my old man. That was when we'd have the most fun. Guys would come by selling funny rabbits that jumped if you squeezed a bulb, and they'd come up to us, and my old man would kid with them. He could talk French just like English, and all those kind of guys knew him, because you could always tell a jockey. And then we always sat at the same table, and they got used to seeing us there. There were guys selling matrimonial papers, and girls selling rubber eggs that when you squeezed them, a rooster came out of them. And one old wormy-looking guy that went by with postcards of Paris, showing them to everybody. And of course, nobody ever bought any. And then he would come back and show the underside of the pack, and they would all be smutty postcards, and lots of people would dig down and buy them. Gee, I remember the funny people that used to go by. Girls around supper time looking for somebody to take them out to eat, and they'd speak to my old man, and he'd make some joke at them in French, and they'd pat me on the head and go on. Once there was an American woman sitting with her kid daughter at the next table to us, and they were both eating ices, and I kept looking at the girl, and she was awfully good looking, and I smiled at her, and she smiled at me, but that was all that ever came of it, because I looked for her mother and her every day, and I made up ways that I was going to speak to her, and I wondered if I'd get to know her, if her mother would let me take her out, to Autel or Tremblay. But I never saw either of them again. Anyway, I guess it wouldn't have been good anyway, because looking back on it, I remember the way I thought out would be best to speak to her was to say, "Pardon me, but perhaps I can give you a winner at Anhine today." And after all, maybe she would have thought I was a tout instead of really trying to give her a winner. We'd sit at the Café de la Pax, my old man and me, and we had a big drag with the waiter, because my old man drank whiskey, and it cost 5 francs, and that meant a good tip when the sauces were counted up. My old man was drinking more than I'd ever seen him, But he wasn't riding at all now, and besides, he said that whiskey kept his weight down. But I noticed he was putting it on all right, just the same. He'd busted away from his old gang out at Mason's, and seemed to like just sitting around on the boulevard with me. But he was dropping money every day at the track. He'd feel sort of doleful after the last race, if he'd lost on that day, until we get to our table, and he'd have his first whiskey, and then he'd be fine. He'd be reading the Paris Sport, and he looked over at me and say, "Where's your girl, Joe?" to kid me, on account of I told him about the girl that day at the next table. And I'd get red, but I liked being kidded about her. It gave me a good feeling. "Keep your eye peeled for her, Joe," he'd say. "She'll be back." He asked me questions about things, and some of the things I'd say, he'd laugh. Then he'd get started talking about things, about riding down in Egypt, or at St. Moritz on the ice, before my mother died, and about during the war, when they had regular races down in the south of France, without any purses or betting or crowd or anything, just to keep the breed up. Regular races with the jocks riding the hell out of the horses. Gee, I could listen to my old man talk by the hour, especially when he'd had a couple or so of drinks. He'd tell me about when he was a boy in Kentucky, and going soon hunting, and the old days in the States before everything went on the bum there. And he'd say, "Joe, when we get a decent stake, you're going back there to the States and go to school." "What if I get to go back there to school for, when everything's on the bum here?" I'd ask him. "Well, that's different," he'd say, and get the waiter over and pay the pile of saucers, and we'd get a taxi to the Gare Saint-Lazare and get on the train out to Mason's. One day, at Autel, after a selling steeplechase, my old man bought in the winner for 30,000 francs. He had to bid a little to get him, but the stable let the horse go finally, and my old man had his permit and his colors in a week. Gee, I felt proud when my old man was an owner. He fixed it up for stable space with Charles Drake and cut out coming into Paris and started his running and sweating out again, and him and I were the whole stable gang. Our horse's name was Guilford. He was Irish bred and a nice, sweet jumper. My old man figured that training him and riding him himself, he was a good investment. I was proud of everything, and I thought Guilford was as good a horse as Czar. He was a good, solid jumper, a bay, with plenty of speed on the flat if he asked him for it, and he was a nice-looking horse, too. Gee, I was fond of him. The first time he started with my old man up, he finished third in a 2,500-meter hurdle race, and when my old man got off him, all sweaty and happy in the place stall, and went in to weigh, I felt as proud of him as though it was the first race he'd ever placed in. You see, when a guy ain't been riding for a long time, you can't make yourself really believe that he ever rode. The whole thing was different now, 'cause down in Milan, even big races never seemed to make any difference to my old man. If he won, he wasn't ever excited or anything. Now, it was so I couldn't hardly sleep the night before a race, and I knew my old man was excited, too, even if he didn't show it. Riding for yourself makes an awful difference. Second time Guilford and my old man started was a rainy Sunday in Autel, in the Prix de Marat, a 4,500-meter steeplechase. As soon as he'd gone out, I beat it up in the stands with the new glasses my old man had bought for me to watch them. They started way over at the far end of the course, and there was some trouble at the barrier. Something with goggle blinders on was making a great fuss, and roaring around and busting the barrier once, but I could see my old man in our black jacket with a white cross and a black cap, sitting up on Guilford and patting him with his hand. Then they were off in a jump, and out of sight behind the trees, and the gong going for dear life and the Perry Mutual wickets rattling. Gosh, I was so excited, I was afraid to look at them. But I fixed the glasses on the place where they would come out, back of the trees, and then out they came with the old black jacket going third, and they all sailing over the jump like birds. Then they went out of sight again, and then they came pounding out and down the hill, and all going nice and sweet and easy, and taking the fence smooth as a bunch, and moving away from us all solid. It looked as though you could walk across on their backs, they were all so hunched and going so smooth. Then they bellied over the big double bullfinch, and something came down. I couldn't see who it was, but in a minute the horse was up and galloping free, and the field all bunched still, sweeping around the long left turn into the straightaway. They jumped the stone wall and came jammed down the stretch toward the big water jump right in front of the stands. I saw them coming and hollered at my old man as he went by, and he was leading by about a length and riding way out over and light as a monkey, and they were racing for the water jump. They took off over the big hedge of the water jump in a pack, and then there was a crash, and two horses pulled sideways out off it and kept on going, and three others were piled up. I couldn't see my old man anywhere. One horse kneed himself up, and the jockey had hold of the bridle and mounted and went slamming on after the place money. The other horse was up and away by himself, jerking his head and galloping with the bridle rein hanging, and the jock staggered over to one side of the track against the fence. Then Guilford rolled over to one side, off my old man, and got up and started to run on three legs, with his hoof dangling. And there was my old man, lying there on the grass, flat out with his face up and blood all over the side of his head. I ran down the stands and bumped into a jam of people and got to the rail, and a cop grabbed me and held me, and two big stretcher bearers were going out after my old man. And around on the other side of the course I saw three horses strung way out, coming out of the trees and taking the jump. My old man was dead when they brought him in, and while the doctor was listening to his heart with a thing plugged in his ears, I heard a shot up the track that meant they'd killed Guilford. I lay down beside my old man when they carried the stretcher into the hospital room and hung on to the stretcher and cried and cried, and he looked so white and gone and so awfully dead, and I couldn't help feeling that if my old man was dead, maybe they didn't need to have shot Guilford. His hoof might have got well. I don't know. I loved my old man so much. Then a couple of guys came in, and one of them patted me on the back, and then went over and looked at my old man, and then pulled a sheet off the cot and spread it over him. And the other was telephoning in French for them to send the ambulance to take him out to Mason's. And I couldn't stop crying and choking, sort of. And George Garner came in and sat down beside me on the floor and put his arm around me and says, "Come on, Joe, old boy. Get up, and we'll go out and wait for the ambulance." George and I went out to the gate, and I was trying to stop bawling, and George wiped off my face with his handkerchief, and we were standing back a little ways while the crowd was going out of the gate, and a couple of guys stopped near us while we were waiting for the crowd to get through the gate, and one of them was counting a bunch of mutual tickets, and he said, "Well, Butler got his all right." And the other guy said, "I don't give a damn if he did, the crook. He had it coming to him on the stuff he's pulled." "I'll say he had," said the other guy, and tore the bunch of tickets in two. And George Gardner looked at me to see if I'd heard. And I had, all right. And he said, "Don't listen to what those bums said, Joe. Your old man was one swell guy." But I don't know. Seems like when they get started, they don't leave a guy nothing. Since we have a good amount of time left this evening, I'd like to throw in another story by Ernest Hemingway. This one is called Out of Season. The way this story is written is quite interesting. There are no quotation marks, which leads me to believe that Mr. Hemingway didn't want separate voices for each of the characters. So I will attempt to read it that way, and hopefully you'll be able to follow. I hope you enjoy this one too. Out of Season by Ernest Hemingway. On the 4 lira he had earned by spading the hotel garden, he got quite drunk. He saw the young gentleman coming down the path and spoke to him mysteriously. The young gentleman said he had not eaten, but would be ready to go out as soon as lunch was finished, 40 minutes or an hour. At the cantina near the bridge, they trusted him for 3 more grappas because he was so confident and mysterious about his job for the afternoon. It was a windy day with the sun coming out from behind clouds and then going under in sprinkles of rain. A wonderful day for trout fishing. The young gentleman came out of the hotel and asked him about the rods. Should his wife come behind with the rods? Yes, said Padusi. Let her follow us. The young gentleman went back into the hotel and spoke to his wife. He and Padusi started down the road. The young gentleman had a musette over his shoulder. Padusi saw the wife, who looked as young as the young gentleman, and was wearing mountain boots and a blue beret, start out to follow them down the road, carrying the fishing rods, unjointed, one in each hand. Padusi didn't like her to be way back there. Signorina, he called, winking at the young gentleman. Come up here and walk with us. Signora, come up here. Let us walk together. Padusi wanted them all three to walk down the street of Cortina together. The wife stayed behind, following rather sullenly. Signorina, Padusi called tenderly. Come up here with us. The young gentleman looked back and shouted something. The wife stopped lagging behind and walked up. Everyone they met, walking through the main street of the town, Padusi greeted elaborately. Buon di, Arturo, tipping his hat. The bank clerk stared at him from the door of the fascist café. Groups of 3 and 4 people standing in front of the shops stared at the three. The workmen in their stone-powdered jackets, working on the foundations of the new hotel, looked up as they passed. Nobody spoke or gave any sign to them except the town beggar, lean and old, with a spittle-thickened beard, who lifted his hat as they passed. Padusi stopped in front of a store with the window full of bottles and brought his empty grappa bottle from an inside pocket of his old military coat. A little drink, some marsala for the signora, something to drink. He gestured with the bottle. It was a wonderful day. Marsala, you like marsala? Signorina, a little marsala? The wife stood sullenly. You'll have to play up at this, she said. I can't understand a word he's saying. He's drunk, isn't he? The young gentleman appeared not to hear Padusi. He was thinking, what in the hell makes him say marsala? That's what Max Beerbaum drinks. Geld, Padusi said finally, taking hold of the young gentleman's sleeve. Lira. He smiled, reluctant to press the subject, but needed to bring the young gentleman into action. The young gentleman took out his pocketbook and gave him a 10 lira note. Padusi went up the steps to the door of the specialty of domestic and foreign wines shop. It was locked. It is closed until 2, someone passing in the street said scornfully. Padusi came down the steps. He felt hurt. Never mind, he said. We can get it at the Concordia. They walked down the road to the Concordia, 3 abreast. On the porch of the Concordia, where the rusty bobsleds were stacked, the young gentleman said, Was wollen Sie? Padusi handed him the 10 lira note folded over and over. Nothing, he said. Anything. He was embarrassed. Marsala, maybe. I don't know. Marsala? The door of the Concordia shut on the young gentleman and the wife. 3 marsalas, said the young gentleman to the girl behind the pastry counter. 2, you mean, she asked. No, he said. 1 for a vecchio. Oh, she said, a vecchio, and laughed, getting down the bottle. She poured out the 3 muddy-looking drinks into 3 glasses. The wife was sitting at a table under the line of newspapers on the sticks. The young gentleman put one of the marsalas in front of her. You might as well drink it, he said. Maybe it'll make you feel better. She sat and looked at the glass. The young gentleman went outside the door with a glass for Padusi, but could not see him. I don't know where he is, he said, coming back into the pastry room carrying the glass. He wanted a quart of it, said the wife. How much is a 1/4 liter? The young gentleman asked the girl. Of the Bianco? 1 lira. No, of the Marsala. Put these 2 in, too, he said, giving her his own glass and the one poured for Padusi. She filled the 1/4 liter wine measure with a funnel. A bottle to carry it, said the young gentleman. She went to hunt for a bottle. It all amused her. I'm sorry you feel so rotten, Tiny, he said. I'm sorry I talked the way I did at lunch. We were both getting at the same thing from different angles. It doesn't make any difference, she said. None of it makes any difference. Are you too cold? He asked. I wish you'd worn another sweater. I've got on 3 sweaters. The girl came in with a very slim brown bottle and poured the Marsala into it. The young gentleman paid 5 lire more and went out the door. The girl was amused. Peduzzi was walking up and down at the other end out of the wind and holding the rods. Come on, he said, I will carry the rods. What difference does it make if anybody sees them? No one will trouble us. No one will make any trouble for me in Cortina. I know them at the Municipio. I have been a soldier. Everybody in this town likes me. I sell frogs. What if it is forbidden to fish? Not a thing. Nothing. No trouble. Big trout, I tell you. Lots of them. They were walking down the hill toward the river. The town was in back of them. The sun had gone under, and it was sprinkling rain. There, said Peduzzi, pointing to a girl in the doorway of a house they passed. My daughter. His doctor, the wife said. He's got to show us his doctor. He said his daughter, said the young gentleman. The girl went into the house as Peduzzi pointed. They walked down the hill, across the field, and then turned to follow the river bank. Peduzzi talked rapidly with much winking and knowingness. As they walked 3 abreast, the wife caught his breath across the wind. Once he nudged her in the ribs. Part of the time he talked in Dampezzo dialect and sometimes in Tyroler German dialect. He could not make out which the young gentleman and his wife understood the best, so he was being bilingual. But as the young gentleman said, Ja, ja, Peduzzi, decided to talk altogether in Tyroler. The young gentleman and the wife understood nothing. Everybody in the town saw us going through with these rods. We're probably being followed by the game police now. I wish we weren't in on this damn thing. This damn fool is so drunk, too. Of course you haven't got the guts to just go back, said the wife. Of course you have to go on. Why don't you go back? Go on back, Tiny. I'm going to stay with you. If you go to jail, we might as well both go. They turned sharp down the bank, and Peduzzi stood, his coat blowing in the wind, gesturing at the river. It was brown and muddy. Off on the right there was a dump heap. Say it to me in Italian, said the young man. Un mezz'oro. Più di un mezz'oro. He said, it's at least 1/2 hour more. Go on back, Tiny. You're cold in this wind anyway. It's a rotten day, and we aren't going to have any fun anyway. All right, she said, and climbed up the grassy bank. Peduzzi was down at the river and did not notice her till she was almost out of sight over the crest. Frau, he shouted. Frau! Fräulein, you're not going. She went on over the crest of the hill. She's gone, said Peduzzi. It shocked him. He took off the rubber bands and held the rod segments together and commenced to joint up one of the rods. But you said it was 1/2 hour further. Oh, yes, it is a good 1/2 hour down. It is good here, too. Really? Of course. It is good here and good there, too. The young man sat down on the bank and jointed up a rod, put on the reel and threaded the line through the guides. He felt uncomfortable and afraid that any minute a gamekeeper or a posse of citizens would come over the bank from town. He could see the houses of the town and the campanile over the edge of the hill. He opened his leader box. Peduzzi leaned over and dug his flat, hard thumb and forefinger in and tangled the moistened leaders. Have you some lead? No. You must have lead. Peduzzi was excited. You must have piombo, piombo, a little piombo just here, just above the hook, or your bait will float on the water. You must have it. Just a little piombo. Have you got some? No. He looked through his pockets desperately, sifting through the cloth dirt in the linings of his inside military pockets. I haven't any. We must have piombo. We can't fish then, said the young gentleman, and unjointed the rod, reeling the line back through the guides. We'll get some piombo and fish tomorrow. But listen, caro, you must have piombo. The line will lie flat on the water. Peduzzi's day was going to pieces before his eyes. You must have piombo. A little is enough. Your stuff is all clean and new, but you have no lead. I would have brought some. You said you had everything. The young gentleman looked at the stream discolored by the melting snow. I know, he said. We'll get some piombo and fish tomorrow. At what hour in the morning, tell me? At 7. The sun came out and was warm and pleasant. The young gentleman felt relieved. He was no longer breaking the law. Sitting on the bank, he took the bottle of Marsala out of his pocket and passed it to Peduzzi. Peduzzi passed it back. The young gentleman took a drink of it and passed it to Peduzzi again. Peduzzi passed it back again. "Drink," he said, "drink. It's your Marsala." After another short drink, the young gentleman handed the bottle over. Peduzzi had watched it closely. He took the bottle very hurriedly and tipped it up, the gray hairs in the folds of his neck oscillating as he drank, his eyes fixed on the end of the narrow brown bottle. He drank it all. The sun shone while he drank. It was wonderful. This was a great day after all, a wonderful day. "Sente caro," in the morning at 7. He had called the young gentleman caro several times, and nothing had happened. It was good Marsala. His eyes glistened. Days like this stretched out ahead. It would begin at 7 in the morning. They started to walk up the hill toward the town. The young gentleman went on ahead. He was quite a way up the hill. Peduzzi called to him. "Listen, caro, can you take me 5 lire for a favor?" "For today?" asked the gentleman, frowning. "No, not today. Give it to me today for tomorrow. I will provide everything for tomorrow. Pane, salami, formaggio, good stuff for all of us. You and I and the signora. Bait for fishing, minnows, not worms only. Perhaps I can get some Marsala. All for 5 lire. 5 lire for a favor." The young gentleman looked through his pocketbook and took out a 2 lire note and 2 ones. "Thank you, caro. Thank you," said Pedruzio, in the tone of one member of the Carlton Club accepting the Morning Post from another. This was living. He was through with the hotel garden, breaking up frozen manure with a dung fork. Life was opening out. "Until 7 o'clock, then, caro," he said, slapping the young gentleman on the back. "Promptly at 7. "I may not be going," said the young gentleman, putting his purse back in his pocket. "What?" said Peduzzi. "I will have minnows, signor. Salami, everything. You and I and the signora, the 3 of us. "I may not be going," said the young gentleman. "Very probably not. I will leave word with the padrone at the hotel office." And that's our show for this evening. I hope you enjoyed these stories by Ernest Hemingway. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.